Hey, today we're joined by Sasha Grafe. Sasha is a designer, coder, and entrepreneur from Paris, France, but he's now living in Osaka, Japan. He's done UI work for some really cool companies, Le Monde, Hipmunk, and Milewise, but he is best known for launching innovative side projects. His most recent projects include Telescope at www.telesc.pe and Sidebar, www.sidebar.io. Aujourd'hui, nous parlons avec Sasha Grafe, une concepteur de produits merveilleux. Sasha réside à Paris, mais nous rejoint en provenance du Japon. Bonjour, Sasha.
Salut. Bon, ben, on peut continuer en français, alors. Ça posera pas de problème.
Now we are officially a bilingual podcast.
Yeah.
Do. That's pretty much the only French I know. I'm sorry.
That was actually really good French.
Was it?
A slight Canadian accent.
Was there a little bit of Quebecois in there?
Yeah, but...
Okay, let's get it going for real here. Welcome to Product People, a podcast focused on great products and the people who make them. My name is Justin Jackson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Kyle Fox.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. And Justin.
And today we have a great guest. Sasha Grafe is joining us from Japan. Welcome to the show, Sasha.
Hey, everybody.
So, Sasha, I thought we would start by hearing your story. So where did you grow up? And maybe tell us how you got into the web and got into computers in the first place.
Okay, sure. So just to explain a little bit who I am, I'm a designer. Just on user interfaces and web mobile apps. For the last years, I've been freelancing for companies, mostly startups. So I've done work for Hipmunk, Ruby Motion, Intercom, so a couple of companies. And right now, I'm focusing more on launching my own products. So the past year, I've launched the Toolbox, which is a small side project that aggregates all kinds of useful links. 1 year ago, I launched Folio, which is a company that helps connect startups and designers. And right now I'm working on Sidebar, which is a community for designers and also a newsletter that sends out the five best design links of the day. I'm French. I grew up in Paris, France. And I got started about 15 years ago, I would say. My first ever website was a walkthrough site for Fallout, the game.
Okay, yeah.
So that was a long time ago. And since then, I've done a lot of things, and actually mostly not web-related. So I went to school after high school. I did 1 year of web stuff, I would say. So learning Flash and PHP and the basics of designing and developing for the web. But that was a long time ago, and the web was really not there yet, I would say. So after that, I went back to university to study computer science. And that had really nothing to do with the web or even like practical programming. It was lots of math and very theoretical. So anyway, after doing this, I also studied Chinese, and I went to China about six times, I think, and lived there for 1 year. So at that point in my life, I was pretty sure I was gonna do something related with Chinese, like, you know, journalist or working in an embassy or something. But it turned out that I got a little bit bored with it, and by chance I found a job in Beijing working in a Chinese web design agency.
Huh.
So
interesting.
This is like how I got back into the web about 5 years ago.
And was there something about that job with the web agency in Beijing that made you like want to build more things on the web?
Yeah, basically, I realized that the web had changed a lot since I was last making sites, and it was a lot more fun. You had so to give you an idea, like when I first started, I was doing table layouts and Flash and really old school stuff. And when I got back into it, I discovered this new thing called CSS.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, that's pretty cool. Beats doing all those stupid table layouts. So discovered WordPress. Like all those things seem really old now, but you know, there was a time before that, the dark ages of the web.
Yeah. And did you discover CSS and WordPress and all of that stuff in Beijing at that first job?
Pretty much. Like I was aware of those things, of course, but I hadn't been doing any design professionally for a while. So, you know, I had never really gone into that too much. So the first thing I did was, okay, read up on the state of the art and, okay, what are people doing now? And when I was Googling, the articles I was finding were like 4 years old or 3 years old. So I realized that, yeah, I had a bit of catching up to do.
Yeah. And what year would that have been when you started doing web development in China?
That was 2007, I think.
Interesting. Now, have you always been into design? Was that always a part of your life?
Not really. I was mostly into the technical side, but I've always been more of a generalist, and I like being able to do everything. So at first, I was basically doing everything, and I realized that the part of that I liked most was design. So I focused on that for a while. And that's the kind of client work I did for a long time. But now that I'm working mostly on my own projects, I actually spend a lot of time coding too.
So what happened after you were in Beijing? Did you move back to France and start like working on like as a freelancer there, or what happened when you after that stage of your life?
So I did move back to France, and for 1 year I worked at UNESCO. Which have their headquarters in France, and I was doing Cold Fusion work, another ugly language that has disappeared, I hope.
Yeah.
But I did that for 1 year, and after that, started freelancing. Basically, I saved up for 1 year to bankroll my freelancing career.
Okay, and so what year was that when you started your freelancing career?
So that would be, let me check, I think that would be 2008.
Right around 2008. And, you know, one thing I always wonder about is what the, like, web culture is like in other places in the world. So what's the web culture like in China, and what's the web culture like in France?
So in China, it's when I was there, they had a very specific kind of design, I would say, and it's a very heavy sites, and a lot of people are using, or worse, using IE and Windows XP, so it was a little bit behind.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's changing, and in China everything changes very fast, so I think they, if they haven't caught up yet, they will in a matter of years. And in France, it's also a little bit behind what you have in the States, but not that much. I would say one thing that's apparent in France is that print designers and animators are very good. So a lot of them went into doing Flash websites.
Mm.
So you still have that really Flash-heavy mindset, and it's probably like disappearing, but for a long time, all the big sites were in Flash, and basically all the best talent went into doing Flash rather than CSS websites.
Interesting. Was there like a community that you could like tap into when you were in France and learning, you know, all this stuff on the web? Were there other people that you connected with and were able to talk this stuff through?
So actually, like, I can only speak for myself, but I've always wanted to, you know, be global and not local. So there was a post by Dennis Severs about that recently, where he basically said that you can, you know, be local and go to local events, or choose to live in the global world, and that means, you know, hanging out on global communities, things like Hacker News, Reddit. So I've always tried to do that more, especially in the beginning of my freelancing career. And as a result, I've never really, you know, had much contact with the local community in France.
But that was an interesting post by Derek Sivers.
Oh, yeah, Derek, sorry. Yeah, but like just before leaving for Japan, actually, I had started being involved more in the Hacker News community in Paris. So it's actually turned out to be pretty cool. So I now think you need a balance between both aspects and not be just 100% global.
That's right.
So one thing that was kind of interesting to me, this is sort of going back a little bit, I guess, you sort of kickstarted your web career back in, you said, 2007-ish in China with the web agency. And then it wasn't very long until you took the plunge into freelance in 2008. It was just over a year, hey?
Yeah. Actually, 2009. Sorry, I checked. So okay. Yeah, in 2007, I was working in China, and in 2008, worked at UNESCO. 2009, started freelancing.
Okay, gotcha. So that's, I guess you had some background in it prior to that, but by some accounts, that's a pretty fast move from web agency to freelance. So I'd be curious, what prompted you to kind of pursue freelance so fast? Was it kind of something you always wanted to do? Like, did you always want to be self-employed and work on interesting products? Or was it just kind of at the time that was the next logical step in your career?
Well, like, as I said, I didn't have a big network in France. And I had some previous agency work in France. And, you know, people were doing lots of Flash, and I didn't have such a good experience, and I thought I might as well try my luck at freelancing and do, you know, whatever I want. And, you know, I was confident I could do it because I started selling themes on ThemeForest. And, right, you know, I thought either it works or it doesn't, but, you know, it's a sink or swim with my own abilities. I wouldn't have clients, I don't have a boss, so it would be a good test of my skills.
Right.
And it turned out that it worked out. I had a few successful templates and themes, and clients started rolling in through ThemeForest at first.
That's interesting. So so you were almost doing products before you were even doing freelance. It kind of like helped you kickstart your way into freelance, and which is kind of like presumably also helping you circle back around to doing more of the product side.
Yeah, I was doing products before I knew I was doing products.
Yeah, before it was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when I first was first doing themes, I had no idea about marketing them or you know, doing any kind of promotion outside of ThemeForest. It never crossed my mind. So if I did it now, I would have a very different approach. But at the time, because ThemeForest is a really good platform, it worked out like this.
Sure. It's kind of like a gateway product.
Yeah.
Interesting.
When did you make the switch from selling things on ThemeForest to starting to sell your own stuff?
So I stopped selling things on ThemeForest because it involved too much customer support. And the competition on ThemeForest is really, really good. I mean, people are coming up with WordPress themes that, you know, you have 20 color variations, you have all these settings, the short codes, whatever. So unless you're doing it full time, I think it's really hard to compete.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I agree.
Yeah, so I stopped doing themes. Then I focused on freelance work for a while. And I guess my first product, well, it's not actually entirely true. I did try to sell some small products on Graphic River, and I kept exploring other options. But I would say my first successful product was my ebook about 6 months ago, last March, I think. But this, it really like came out of the blue for me. I never expected it would be that successful or, you know, bring in that much money.
So why did you decide to make the ebook in the first place? What was kind of the reason behind that?
You know, people ask me that, but I don't think there was a reason. Like, it was more, hey, that would be a cool thing to do, and let's try it out. You know, most of my projects start out like this. Like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if, and then I do it. So, yeah, I wanted to try that, see if there was an audience for it, and it turned out that there was.
So maybe take us through that process a little bit. So at first you were just thinking, hey, this would be kind of neat to try this. And then you built it, wrote the book. What happened next?
So the first thing is the book is actually pretty short. So, you know, that's because I wanted to give it a try, and it's kind of a book MVP, or most minimum viable product.
Yeah.
So I didn't set out to write a, you know, 200-page book. I set out to write a 40-page ebook and give it a shot. And after that, I built a landing page for it, and then posted the link to Hacker News, and just took off.
And so, and when you posted it to Hacker News, did you have a price? Like, were you linked to a landing page with a price where people could buy it?
Yeah, I linked to the current landing page, which is still online. And at that time, it was half priced. So that was like really cheap. So the lowest edition was $3. And actually, I think a lot of people bought it just because it was so cheap.
Yeah.
And I didn't do a lot of market research or anything on ebooks, so I actually priced it based on the iPhone apps, because I figured, hey, people are spending like all these months on those iPhone apps, like Angry Birds, whatever, and selling them for only $1, so I'm going to do something a similar price, which, like, it turns out is a really bad way to price things. I've learned since then, but, you know.
Yeah, I noticed, because you released your book right around the time that bootstrapping design came out, and there was a little bit of a back and forth between you guys on you know, what pricing model was best. So how do you feel about that now? Like, what now that you're at this stage, do you think you should have priced it higher, or do you think that your price was kind of right on the mark?
I think I should have probably priced it a little bit higher, but, you know, it's easy to say now because the book was successful, so it seems more valuable. Like, if the book hadn't sold anything, I would probably be like, hey, I should have priced it lower.
Yeah.
So, basically what I took from all this is that, you know, you can price high or low. What matters most is, you know, why you're doing and like your overall strategy. It's not so much the specific price point. So yeah, just read up on pricing strategy and why different pricing points work, and then, you know, do your best. But it's not like you have to price high or you have to price low.
Mm-hmm. Do you think are you going to do another book?
Actually, yeah, I'm in the process of doing one right now. But on a very different subject. So it's going to be about Meteor, JavaScript framework. And it's going to be about, you know, an introduction of how to build an app with Meteor. from scratch, basically.
Interesting. Do you think you'll what's your going to be your pricing strategy for that book?
There's two of us on the project, so I'm writing it with Tom Coleman, which is one of the best meter devs in the community right now, I think. So the pricing is going to be higher to support both of us, and also because it's going to be a much more in-depth product with more material.
And so you guys are thinking it's going to be a higher price point and with a lot more material. So you think videos, examples.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Basically, if you look at what Nathan Barry is doing, I think it's going to be something like this.
Interesting. Kyle and I were just talking about the Nathan Barry book today.
Yeah. Yeah. He launched yesterday.
And
looks super well done. Like, it's one of those landing pages that makes you just need to have it right this instant.
Well,
he's got a pretty aggressive pricing strategy too, and it, like, the price tag doesn't really feel like it deters me a whole lot. Maybe it prevented me from buying like right now type thing, but I mean, it's still rattling around in my head right now as something I want to get as soon as I can, even though it's, you know, about $200.
Well, he has three price points, actually.
Right.
So you can get the budget option for, $30?
Yeah. Yeah, you can buy the book for $30. It's on sale right now. You can buy the book plus videos for $80. You can buy the whole package, which includes video tutorials, video interviews, resources, and the book for $200. And then you can buy a team version for like a team license for $800.
And you can buy a gold-plated version for $2,000.
Well, you know, what's interesting, though, is like on communities like Hacker News, this kind of pricing is getting kind of torn apart. Like, a lot of people were kind of taken aback by the pricing.
Yeah.
What do you think about that, Sasha?
They don't know what they're talking about. That's what I think about it.
Yeah, like, so Justin and I were talking a little bit about this earlier as well, because we both kind of manage teams, and, you know, for a business that's got a team of designers and sort of like, if you have new people, new designers joining the team, you want to bring them up to speed and have a common frame of reference for everyone on the team. You know, spending $800 on a whole bunch of well designed, like, just high quality collateral like that is almost a no-brainer. Like, $800, yeah. $1,000 for something that your whole team can refer back to and use to train up new hires, like, that's incredible value.
And I think people don't understand how, like, segmentation works, really. Because if you want to buy a car and you know you can buy a Ferrari or, what's a cheap brand, a Honda, and you know that those two cars are for different audiences, so you're not going, nobody's complaining about the price of Ferraris because you know they're expensive, that's what they are. And it's the same thing here, except it's the same product, but it also has different price points. So just like you can buy a cheap car or an expensive car, you can buy a cheap package or an expensive package. So if you think the expensive package is too expensive, that just means you're not the target audience, so it's not for you. That's all there is to it.
Yep, exactly.
And I guess the real proof...
I think people feel like insulted somehow.
Yeah, so maybe explain a little bit about that, because you had a very low price and it sounds like there wasn't that much friction. Like, people said, oh, $2, I'll pay for that.
Yeah.
No problem. Why do you think some people are offended when the price goes up?
Well, because they think, hey, you want me to pay $200 for this? I can't afford it. Are you crazy? So what they don't understand is that, no, Nathan Barry doesn't want you to pay that. He wants, you know, the guy at the big company who is not spending his money to pay that. I mean, in this case, the people complaining, you know, it would be one thing is somebody at a big company was complaining about the pricing point, saying that, you know, they can't afford it or whatever, but usually the people complaining are not the targets. So in my case, people, I guess the price point had a good, very good reception on Hacker News because those people were the target of that price point, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what do you think you're going to do to promote your next book? If Hacker News is an interesting community because you can get a lot of traffic. If it hits a chord, you can get a lot of traffic. Do you have some ideas on how you might promote something with a higher price point?
So I've already started setting up a mailing list on the Telescope site. So Telescope is an open source Meteor app that we're building to let anybody basically create their own Hacker News or Reddit style website. So it's an open source social news app. So if you go check out the landing page for that app, so the app is free, but there's a small sign-up form for the book's mailing list. So that's step one. Just collect some email address, and then you can use that to, you can send sample chapters to people. You can ask them feedback on what they'd like to see in the book. So there's lots of things you can do. And after that, we'll see. I mean, book is like,
One thing I'm kind of curious about, because Justin, I'm not sure how like into the like the hardcore tech scene you are, but Meteor is like a pretty new sort of framework to build apps in.
Yeah, I haven't heard much about it. Well, I only heard about it because I saw Telescope on Hacker News. Yeah. So could you just describe to me what Meteor is?
Okay, so you know about Node.js?
Yeah.
Which is JavaScript on the server. Meteor is based on that, but it takes it one step further so that, you know, you can share code between the server and the client. So not only is your whole app JavaScript, but you can even reuse the same methods and the same exact same code on both sides. And that's one thing. The other thing is it's all real time. So basically, if you're displaying like whatever data from the database you're displaying on your site, if it gets updated, it will be updated on the site in real time without you needing to do anything about it.
Huh.
So it's almost magical how it works, and it's really powerful. And on top of this, it does lots of smart things, like it includes all your apps file by default, so you know you don't even need to do the script tags or CSS tags. Everything gets included and compiled, minified, all that. So I've tried. I built app with PHP, WordPress, Rails, but Meteor is really like a step above, and I think it's the future.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I wanted to ask you about, because it's pretty new. Like, I think it's really interesting that you guys decided to build such a polished, marketable app with Meteor. So I'm kind of wondering, what made you decide to use Meteor, or if you were approached by like the Meteor team to use this as a kind of like a marketing tool to promote Meteor? Because like, especially with the book, I think it's interesting because right now there might not be, like today there might not be a huge market of people looking to learn Meteor. Surely there's some, but it seems like this could be, you know, very well timed where, as Meteor kind of gains popularity, and I agree with you, I think this is kind of the future of web apps. So you're positioning yourself quite nicely to be one of the first really polished, thorough kind of Meteor books. So I'm wondering,
I hope so.
Sort of how you got into Meteor. What made you decide to write this book?
Mm-hmm. Well, for starters, the thing about the market, I think the Meteor market might be small, but Meteor also has a very low barrier to entry. And there are a ton of people who already know JavaScript, front-end developers, designers, and they could get started with Meteor in one day. You know, they don't have to learn a new language. They don't have, they can install the Meteor in like in 5 minutes. So I don't look at the market as people who are using Meteor. For me, the market is people who know JavaScript, basically, and that market is huge. And to answer your question, so first, I actually came up with the idea for Telescope first, because even before that, I wanted to build what is now Sidebar. So Sidebar, if you check it out now, it doesn't really look anything like Telescope or Hacker News or all those sites, but it's actually based on Telescope, so Telescope powers it. And the reason why is because my initial goal was, and still is actually, to build something like a Hacker News for designers, because I think that's really missing right now. So I had this idea, okay, I want to build a Hacker News for designers, how do I do that? So the first step was choosing the technology and choosing who I was going to build it with. And my initial idea was to exchange my design time on somebody else's project for their coding time on my project. And I found someone to do that, and we started. He was a Node.js coder. And yeah, so I narrowed down the technology's choice to either Rails or Node.js, because I had experience with Rails and I also knew JavaScript, so I figured those two stacks would be the easier for me to learn. So anyway, we picked Node.js, and at the same time, I have a friend who is in Y Combinator, who's doing Zenbox, who said he was friends with the Meteor guys, and they were some cool people, and Meteor was interesting. So we decided to check it out. And what happened is the guy that was helping me out, so he started building this in Meteor, but after a while, he got busy, and we kind of lost touch, so I ended up doing the app by myself. And it turned out that Meteor like was easy enough for me to just build it out and do a big part of it by myself. And after a while, I was joined by Tom Coleman, which is now my partner on the project. But like by that time, I had the confidence that I could actually, you know, build non-trivial stuff with Meteor.
So you found it pretty empowering as a designer that you could use Meteor to build this app yourself, that you didn't need to find someone that was more technical. Interesting.
To be fair, like I'm not a pure designer because I have a computer science background and I've done a couple apps, but you know, Meteor, like I can compare Meteor to Rails because I'm also maintaining Folio, which is a Rails app, and Meteor is hands down a lot more fun to use and yeah, just more intuitive for me than Rails.
Well, you've actually just in this conversation kind of convinced me that this is probably what I'm going to spend my weekend doing, taking a closer look at it, because I remember being impressed by like the screencast and things like that, and then I saw that you had built Telescope, and it suddenly, I don't know, I'm maybe a little bit superficial, but I was like, oh, hey, there's a pretty site about Meteor. Suddenly I can take it seriously. So.
Well, I would say if you're building a real-time app in any way, Meteor is definitely the way to go. And even if your app is not real-time or like doesn't need to be, I think it's still a pretty good candidate just because it's so quick and simple.
Right. And like you said, based on JavaScript is a huge
app. Yeah, based on JavaScript. To be fair, there are some quirks, like, you know, because of the real-time aspects, some things are harder to do than with a traditional framework, but I think those things are going to go away pretty fast. And I mean, I will still recommend it even with those things.
Yeah, I remember, I think one of the first things that everyone sort of yelled about on Hacker News was that it was not great for SEO. And then eventually like an SEO package or fix came along. So it seems like it's one of those things where, you know, any new tool is going to have gaps and things like that, but they get smoothed over in time. So it's not, it doesn't mean the project is inherently doomed. So they seem to be doing it, doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, exactly.
And how,
I mean,
sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I mean, sure. It doesn't have like the libraries of Ruby or Node, but it's a young product. It's, that's true. But I still think it's worth it, you know, getting ahead of the curve and getting familiarized with it now.
Right. And the best way to do that is your upcoming ebook.
Yeah.
Do you have a landing page up for that yet?
There's the Telescope landing page. There's no landing page for the ebook itself yet.
Okay.
But just to know that Telescope is open source, so anybody can, you know, download it and look at the code. It's pretty simple code and with lots of comments, so it should be understandable for everybody.
Yeah. And has anyone else, I noticed you have three examples of people who are using it. Have you heard from other people that are already using it for like real communities that they're building?
Yeah, a couple of people. Some people are using it for communities or their own like link blog. Some people are also using it more as a collaboration tool.
Yeah.
Like an internal Hacker News.
Oh, that's a cool idea.
That's what I thought it would be good for, is like running product teams internally. You could have your whole backlog in Telescope and allow people to vote it up, like vote up ideas, comment on ideas, and you could kind of see what was hot. And that would be really neat to have something like Telescope just running, you know, internally for, you know, just for that.
Yeah. And you can run it for free on Meteor or Heroku. You can customize it yourself. It's just JavaScript. So yeah, I think it's a perfect idea.
Well, that rounds up part one of our interview with Sasha Grafe. We have an amazing part two coming for you next week. Sasha talks about choosing a partner and the importance of side projects. But even more, he gets really personal about the challenges of bootstrapping your own product. You will not want to miss it. We will see you then.